Imagine a grocery store large enough to feed thousands of hungry people in 33 counties. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, we'll learn about the challenging mission of the Tri-State Food Bank. My guest is Food Bank Director Glenn Roberts. He used to run the show at the Evansville Philharmonic Orchestra. Now it's musical chairs with forklifts, delivery trucks, and tons of foodstuffs. So how much food is needed? Where is it coming from? Where is it going? And the importance of food drives and volunteers, and a strange donation of chicken feet. The pandemic is making the role of the Tri-State Food Bank even more important than ever. I'm David James. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Are you hungry right now? Well, no problem for most of us. A fast food restaurant is usually nearby. There's always delivery. Or just go to the fridge or the pantry to see what you can cook up in a hurry. But for a growing number of our neighbors, putting food on the table is becoming more difficult. And the pandemic, of course, is making matters even worse. The term food insecurity is used to describe this struggle to feed the hungry among us. The Tri-State Food Bank is taking on an even greater role these days, serving as a warehouse for food pantries in 33 counties and expanding its services to meet the growing demand for healthy food, including a menu of services, including backpack meals for school kids and senior meal boxes. So who's in charge of this giant food distribution system? Well, it's time to meet my guest, Glenn Roberts, Executive Director of the Tri-State Food Bank in Evansville. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you for having me, David. Appreciate being here.
Now, let's start with this good news. We're recording this conversation one day after the Evansville City Council approved the Mayor's Commission on Food Insecurity, unanimous approval. Mm-hmm. And so that's got to be great news.
It is. It's been in the works for a while, but the mayor had this idea of bringing everyone to the table, all the people who are involved in fighting hunger and food security, and let's share ideas, let's share resources if possible, and attack this from a collaborative standpoint.
Now, so how do you define food security or insecurity?
Food insecurity is just another way of saying financial insecurity, really. It just means you do not have enough money to buy groceries. You've fallen into hard times. And so food insecurity is simply that. It all boils down to money. And, you know, food is a basic necessity, and we all need to go to the grocery store. But if you don't have the money, you start making those terrible choices of do I pay my rent, or do I buy groceries? Do I get my medications, or do I buy groceries? So that's what food insecurity is.
Now, of course, the pandemic has exacerbated the situation, increasing the request for food.
Yes, it has, all across the country, of course, with all the job losses and the layoffs and everything. Here in the tri-state, Feeding America estimates that our food insecurity rate has increased maybe about 35%. Other places in the country, though, have been much harder hit.
Just in the past year?
Yes, since the pandemic. So here in the tri-state, one way to look at it is before the pandemic, we had about 1 in 6 people who were food insecure. Now it's 1 in 5. And for children, it's even higher. We've gone from 1 in 5 children to 1 in 4 who are food insecure. Many people are facing food insecurity for the very first time, and they don't know what to do. And, of course, we direct them to go to our website and look up a list of our agencies. They are listed by county, and you can find a soup kitchen or a pantry that can serve you. And these are the most compassionate people in the world that you will meet who will help you get the food you need.
And just a side note to this, you were diagnosed with COVID-19.
I was indeed. In the month of September was a lousy month for me. I was diagnosed with COVID, did not have a severe case of COVID. My symptoms were rather mild, but it kind of turned into other things. My immune system went out of whack, and it led to some other very unpleasant things. And actually, I'm still recovering. Maybe I'm one of those long-haul COVIDs, but yes, bad timing for me to get COVID, but As soon as I could, I felt terrible for about 3 or 4 days, and then I felt good enough to get out the laptop. I was in quarantine in my house. My wife was bringing me food and water and leaving it outside my door. But no, COVID-19 is no fun. I don't recommend it.
Now, your service area, I took a tour of your facility, and you have this map there, 33 counties in 3 states, and you told me it covers some 12,000 square miles?
That's right. We have 33 counties, 9 in Indiana, 8 in Kentucky, and 16 in Illinois. That's our service area. Yeah, about 12,000 square miles. Big territory.
Like a small country. really?
Well, that's why we just bought 2 new trucks. You know, we were increasing our truck fleet because we make deliveries to those far-flung counties.
And you go all the way almost to Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
That's right.
Right at the border there. And then you go all the way down to the Tennessee-Kentucky border.
That's right. We do. Big territory.
It is. Now, your new facility on Lynch Road is, I guess, just massive. I mean, that's the best way to describe it. It's quite a contrast to the old building. And talk about that contrast, Glenn.
It is massive compared to where we came from. The food bank started in 1982 in one small warehouse. And as they grew, they owned property and they built a second warehouse. And then as they grew, they built a third warehouse. And they had a fourth office building. So they were in 4 buildings. And of course, we had far outgrown it. And we had plans to move into a new facility or actually purchase and build a new facility. Plans to build a new facility didn't pan out. It's just simply too expensive. We found the property on Lynch Road, and it fit all of the – we could check off all the boxes of what we needed for square footage, the office space, the location. We were thrilled. So we've actually tripled our warehouse space. We've grown not just horizontally but vertically. It's tall, and we can stack more food. So we are thrilled to be in our new facility.
And you told me it was a former Tupperware complex?
Yes. It was originally built as a Tupperware manufacturing facility. And I find it amusing. I think it's come full circle because if you think about it, Tupperware is about taking leftover food, storing it properly, and making sure it gets eaten. And that's what we do at the food bank.
Now, you were my tour guide on this trip around the warehouse. It's impressive, and the space you have is massive, but it's starting to fill up.
Incredibly so, yes. That's a pandemic will do that. And we did move right in the middle of the pandemic in June. As when the pandemic hit in March, we were faced with that decision, do we go forward with the renovation? And I didn't skip a beat. I said, we must move forward because we need the space. We need to distribute more food. And also at that time, I was learning about second surges that were happening in other countries. So I said, we must move forward. See, we have a 10-year plan to distribute enough food that take food insecurity rates basically to zero, that there be enough food out there. And now we've like leapfrogged about 7 years or 8 years into that plan. And it's amazing how quickly that warehouse is filled up. But we are turning that inventory and making sure the food gets to people who need it.
But you do have some room to expand there.
We do indeed. We actually have a mezzanine, an industrial mezzanine that I never thought that we'd be using it. When we purchased the building, I looked at it and I thought this was just extra space, unless there's some big catastrophe of some sort, long before COVID. And now here we are, and we're looking at storing food in the mezzanine now.
My guest is Glenn Roberts. He's executive director of the Tri-State Food Bank, which is facing even greater demands during this pandemic. Now, I understand you have a driver that just goes around to local groceries and picking up items?
That's right. One of our employees, a driver, that's their full-time job, is to go around daily to the grocery stores like Sam's Club and Costco and pick up the fresh items and a lot of the bread that they have to donate. So that's a full-time job in and of itself.
And you also have like a mini market inside the food bank.
Yes, for our agencies who come to Tri-State Food Bank to pick up their order, they get a nice bonus in that we will have these fresh items, you know, like deli items and fresh produce and the bread. And we call it the shopping area. And they get to pretty much have their pick, I mean, with some limits, mm-hmm. but they get to pick all of these fresh items and good, healthy food because we want to promote good, healthy eating, and this is a way that the pantries can provide that so that people are getting not just a can of green beans and mac and cheese, but they're getting fresh produce to make salads and to cook with.
I even saw some rotisserie chicken in there.
That's right. We get...
And some baked goods and some cakes and treats.
Yeah, we get just about everything, and sometimes we get some very unusual donations.
Such as...
I kind of led you into that one.
Thank you.
I'll tell a story. Now, this actually happened before I was at the food bank, but we have one employee who's been there 22 years. He has seen everything. He's our food source manager. And he tells the story of someone called and said they had chicken to donate. And we don't hesitate. We say, sure, we'll take the chicken. Well, they weren't very specific. And what it was chicken feet. It wasn't the breast, it wasn't the thighs, it wasn't quarter, it was chicken feet, the actual feet. And John was wondering, what in the world do we do with this? And I think he did a little research, and he found a food bank, a Feeding America food bank in Louisiana. And they took it right away because there's something called chicken feet soup, and there are a lot of cultures that like this soup. It looks... like something out of a horror movie. But I did some research, and chicken feet is actually high in what's called collagen. It's a protein, and it's good for joint pain and preventing bone loss. So it's actually very healthy. It's just very weird to eat.
Well, how did this person have a mass of chicken feet?
That I don't know. Maybe that's a question you just don't ask.
Okay, that's true. Okay. And also, when I was on your tour, you had just received a huge shipment of potatoes, tons and tons of potatoes.
Yes, and what you saw were, these were government commodity potatoes, so these were provided through the state of Indiana. But if you'd been here the week before, we got other potatoes from a very unusual source, and that is a semi-truck within the area had an accident, overturned. And this actually happens more often than you would think, that a truck with food, if they have an accident, whoever was going to receive it, you know, you can't receive it. It's damaged goods, but most of that food may have done fine.
Sure.
So we went out there, and we brought big containers, and we gathered up these potatoes, and they were still in good shape, and we were able to distribute them.
Score.
That's
a good one, definitely. Now, of course, you don't want this food to stay on the shelves, so it's get it in and move it out.
That's right, especially the perishable items. We want to move that out just as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And one way we can do that, and a growing part of our organization, is our mobile food distributions, where we will get a truck, load it up with food, and go to a site and just sort of set up shop. And now with COVID, doing food distributions is all drive-through. And cars pull up, and you'll have a box of prepacked food and maybe some produce, maybe some bananas, maybe some potatoes, maybe some milk. And we will give the clients the food, put it in the trunk, and off they go. But it's a good way for us to distribute this fresh produce, which is, of course, highly perishable.
Now, there's so many agencies involved, and sometimes it gets confusing. So how are you guys involved with Feeding America?
Well, we are a member of Feeding America. Feeding America, believe it or not, is the nation's second largest charity. And what Feeding America is essentially the network of food banks. The entire United States is divided into, think of it as 200 markets or regions. Mm-hmm. And our market is the 33 counties that we serve. So we are all interconnected. It's a wonderful network. It's like a brotherhood and sisterhood of food banks. We share best practices, ideas. We share food. Feeding America can raise a lot of money to help the food banks. And that's been a very big blessing here during the pandemic. People have been very, very generous to the food bank and to Feeding America. So Feeding America is, you know, they have their rules and their policies. You have to qualify to be a Feeding America food bank.
Is this non-political?
It's completely non-political.
Okay.
Yeah. Very, very bipartisan, I suppose. Feeding America is a nonprofit. It's a charity.
Well, now, still ahead, we're going to find out more about where all this food is coming from. It just keeps coming, thank goodness. Also, the coolers to keep the perishables from going bad. And we'll learn more about my guest, Glenn Roberts, his career with the Evansville Philharmonic. And he is now orchestrating probably one of the biggest grocery warehouses in the Midwest. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. NPR compiled a special report on food insecurity in the U.S. by the numbers. And here are some important findings in that report. Researchers at Northwestern University say food insecurity more than doubled due to the pandemic, hitting as many as 23% of households in 2020. That's more than 35 million Americans who were either unable to acquire food to meet their needs or uncertain where they would get their next meal. The NPR report also found the problem was even worse among Black and Hispanic families, with Black families twice as likely as white families to face food insecurity. And another disturbing finding, food insecurity has more than tripled among households with children, up to nearly 30%. And a separate study by the United Nations says the pandemic could double the number of people experiencing extreme food insecurity from 135 million to 265 million worldwide. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Glenn Roberts, Executive Director of the Tri-State Food Bank, just off Lynch Road in Evansville, a location, Glenn, that's beloved by truck drivers because it's easy in and easy out.
Yes, our old facility, to get the trucks, and you had to be a master truck driver. And in the past few years, we've had a water sewer problem right in front of our dock area. And so the truck drivers had to negotiate an even tighter turn. Now at Lynch Road, we have so many docks and so much space. The truck drivers finally go, I enjoy going to Tri-State Food Bank now.
So when did you open up in the Lynch Road facility?
1st of June. Yes, we bought the facility last August of 2019 and worked on getting contractors. The construction started in January and it was a 6-month project.
Wow. Yeah. Now, before you took on the challenge of feeding the Tri-State, Glenn, you were in the entertainment business with the Evansville Philharmonic Orchestra. Interesting transition of jobs. What did you do with the Philharmonic?
Well, I was the executive director there for 7.5 years. Yeah, I moved here to Evansville in 2005, and I had been an executive director of other orchestras. I had a career as a musician. I started off as a performer, a trombone player, and transitioned into teaching, and then I transitioned into management. And when my wife and I wanted to move to the Midwest to raise our children and just establish a wonderful home here. I suppose when I was with the Philharmonic, you'd say I was feeding souls.
There you go.
Yes. And now I'm feeding people, feeding their stomachs.
Where'd you grow up?
Well, that's a little bit of a trick question. I was born in Georgia, but I did grow up in Dallas, Texas, and went to school, got my music degree from IU Bloomington, the world's best music school, if I say so myself. And I've lived all over. I've lived in New York City. I've played Carnegie Hall. I've toured Europe when I was a trombone player. And I've had quite an interesting life.
Well, tell me about some of these overseas tours. What orchestra were you with?
Originally, my first tour ever to Europe, I was with an orchestra called the National Orchestra Association, and they were a semi-professional orchestra in New York City, and they brought in wonderful guest conductors, and we performed in Carnegie Hall, and so I can say I made it to Carnegie Hall, yes. And then I also went to Europe when I was a manager with the Boston Youth Orchestra. They would go on international tours every other year and took them to Italy and to Sweden and Norway and in England, so Finland. So I've had wonderful experiences with my music going to exotic places.
And some great venues, I bet.
Yes. Outside of Florence, there's an amphitheater, And it is just a perfect outdoor amphitheater. The acoustics are just amazing. It's all open air, but you can hear someone on the stage just a whisper. Hmm. It's extraordinary. Of course, the view is of Tuscany Hills.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
There's a beautiful cemetery there of American soldiers who died in Italy outside of Florence, and that wonderful countryside there. It's fascinating.
Yes. I know the cemetery you're talking about. My wife and I, we took our dream vacation to Italy in November of 2019, just this past November. We've been planning this for decades. We went to that cemetery. Mm-hmm. And now we think with COVID, we just got out under the wire because it was right after that. It had just exploded. So we got to Italy just in time.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. My wife and I, we took a Baltic cruise in 2019.
Really?
The summer of 2019.
Uh-huh.
So we were lucky to get that trip out of the way before everything hit.
Yeah.
And like 6 months later.
Right. Well, 2019... our Italy trip was wonderful. We did two other things, kind of like you. These mm-hmm. like once-in-a-lifetime things. We went to a Cubs game. My wife is a diehard Cubs fan and just never able to go to a game. So we went to a Cubs game. They won, which is even a bonus.
Wow.
And then, you see, my wife's a cellist, and our two daughters are cellists. Yo-Yo Ma performed in Millennium Park in Chicago. And he performed all six of the Bach unaccompanied cello suites. And I stood in line for hours to make sure that we got some good seats. Magical, magical evening. And it's like 40,000 people, you know, crammed into Millennium Park. Again, a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And no social distancing in mm-hmm. 2019. And it was still a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And you wonder if we're ever going to be able to have those types of experiences
sure.
again.
Tell me about any difference between the audiences in Europe and in the U.S.?
I tell you, I believe so. And it's because much of that music was born there. The same way that here in the United States, if you go to a good jazz concert, there's something about it. You know, so much of jazz was born here on this soil. We would go to, when I was with the orchestra, it was called the Puccini Festival Orchestra when I just graduated college, and we performed Italian music. We went there and we performed all these arias from the great Italian operas, and the Italians just loved it, because it's their music. It's their music. They go around and they publicize the concert, build the stage, just nothing like it.
Your wife is a musician. Where did you guys meet?
We met in Dallas, Texas. She had gotten her master's from Southern Methodist University and was in Dallas, and she was a freelance musician, a teacher, and playing in orchestras. And I was managing the Greater Dallas Youth Orchestras. And I had hired her as a coach of the cello section for the youth orchestra. I didn't know her. Someone said, hey, you need to call up Kristen. So I called her. First time I saw her, lovely woman, and I just assumed she was married. And then I had to ask someone. I said, is she seeing somebody? And I finally got smart and looked at her left hand and no ring and thought, oh, goodness. So, I mean, we got married less than a year later. And when you find the right person, you find the right person.
Making beautiful music together.
Yes.
Ever since. Very good. Glenn Roberts is my guest. He's the executive director of the Tri-State Food Bank. Now, of course, you had experience working with people and guest artists with the Philharmonic. Solving problems was probably one of your duties there as the head honcho. Any memory standing out of any conflicts or snafus involving a performance?
You know,
You just did such a good job.
Well, I know. If there were a lot of snafus, I wasn't doing my job right. Honestly, nothing stands out. Not here in Evansville. I can tell you, early in my career, my first job as an executive director was with the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic, and we brought in for a fundraiser David Clayton Thomas, with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And it was an outdoor venue, and we thought this was just going to sell tickets like crazy. And we got this was in August, and we had some sort of weird cold front move through. It was like, you know, 50 degrees outside. No one bought tickets. There was like 12 people in the audience. Oh, the orchestra was out there. David Clayton Thomas, he came. He looked at the crowd and he said, "I'm not going on stage." And but I turned to him. I held up his contract and I said, "Yes, you are." What goes up must come down.
Definitely. Okay, let's go back to the Tri-State Food Bank.
Please.
And, okay, let's talk about the importance of the volunteers who do a lot of the peace work there at the food bank.
Oh, we couldn't do what we do without volunteers. I mean, that's our workforce right there. I mean, we have 26 employees, but we have like 1,300 volunteers who come in and help us. They pack meal boxes for senior citizens, backpacks, weekend backpacks for kids. We could not live without them. Although, when the pandemic hit, that was our first and probably our biggest crisis, was losing our volunteers. Many of them are senior citizens, and understandably, you know, they just could not go out and do volunteer work like this. So that really hit us hard early in the pandemic. Slowly, we were able to attract younger people, and then we were able to put in social distancing and doing things safely, and people felt more comfortable coming back.
You're very proud of your conveyor belt.
Yes, we have a conveyor table with rollers because we pack so many meal boxes. The people can stand 6 feet apart and put in their item and then roll that box down to the next person.
And there's a special room just for the volunteers.
Yes.
Away from the warehouse.
Yeah, well, it's actually nestled within the warehouse. It's just all enclosed.
Mm. There's no forklift trucks in the vicinity of them.
Correct. They're nice and protected, mm-hmm. and a climate-controlled environment. We're very proud of our volunteer center, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, where does all this food come from? It must be several sources.
Many sources for our food. One big source, about 30-35% of our food actually does come from the government. These are commodity items. The government purchases these foods, they're surplus foods, and they distribute them to Feeding America food banks. And we use those products in our senior meal boxes, and much of that food goes to our pantries and our soup kitchens. So that's about 30-35% of our food. As you can imagine, 50% or more than half of our food is donated. Various sources of that. You mentioned the grocery stores earlier. That's one source. We also get food straight from food manufacturers. I mean, by the truckload. There might be a food manufacturer who says, you know, I've got two truckloads to donate. And there's a very interesting system that Feeding America has come up with of how us food banks actually vie for this food. And I call it the eBay of food banking. It is a bidding process. We are given shares. It's not money, but these are shares that are replenished on a monthly basis. And an item will come up for bid, and you bid on it, just like eBay. And there's a deadline. And then you find out, you know, who won the bid.
Really?
Yeah. And maybe that's where we got the chicken feet, and we just didn't know they were chicken feet.
Now, you also have these, three system of coolers, cool, cold, and colder.
Right. In our warehouse, the warehouse is so spacious that we were able to build our cold storage system all within the building, so nothing is outside and subject to the elements. And we wanted to keep the cold chain unbroken, which is best practice. So when trucks with refrigerated product come, they come to special docks, and we unload it, and it goes straight into what we call the cold dock, and we keep that at about 50 degrees, and it's about 2,000 square feet. Good place to store a lot of produce. From there, if it needs to go into the cooler, we have a 3,000-foot square foot cooler. We keep that about 40 degrees, and from there, it's connected to the freezer, and we keep that right at about 0 or 5 below.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've done some research into the food bank world, and food banks are kind of a relatively new phenomenon.
They really are. This is an industry that's been around only a few decades. The late 60s, I think it was 1969, it all started in Phoenix, Arizona. And one man had this idea. He had noticed that people who operated pantries were actually dumpster diving behind grocery stores just to get some extra food. And he thought, there's got to be a better way. And he came up with this concept of a food bank. It really dedicated to acquiring mass quantities of food, you know, large donations, and getting donations from food manufacturers and warehousing it and distributing it to the pantries and soup kitchens. And so that takes a burden off of them, you know, and keep them from dumpster diving. Interesting concept, beautiful idea, and it kind of took off like wildfire across the country. And large communities, small communities developed this concept of a food bank. And what is now called Feeding America used to be called America's Second Harvest. They are the ones that kind of like tied together these food banks, get them to talk to each other, get them to maybe share ideas or share food if possible. And now it has grown exponentially. It's a wonderful, wonderful network, again, because we share ideas, best practices, and we share food.
Now, of course, the food bank serves all these different agencies that help the poor. And that includes, I guess, the rescue mission and places like that, other shelters.
Yes. We supply food to the rescue mission. I mean, so we have about 40 of these agencies just here in the Evansville area. Now, you get out to the rural communities, and, of course, it's sparsely populated, and there are very few pantries and those types of agencies. And we are thrilled to be able to help them, but that's where we have to do more and hit those pockets in the rural communities with the mobile food distributions. But we have, in total, about 150 partner agencies, mostly pantries, but also soup kitchens and shelters.
Now, and you told me that some of these trips to these outlying areas takes a day. It's a day-long trip there and back.
It's a full day for us to go from Evansville to Cairo, Illinois. I mean, that's a good 3-hour drive. So the truck driver's got to get up, have his truck loaded, do the 3-hour drive, and then unload the truck there at the agency. And it's somewhere along the line they got to stop and eat lunch.
That's right.
And come back. It's a long day just to make one trip.
Now, coming up, the importance of food drives, and one in particular we'll talk about, the School Spirit Challenge, which has really taken off in recent years. And what's on the plate as my guest, Glenn Roberts, looks ahead to the future of the Tri-State Food Bank. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. So what does hunger look like in Indiana? Feeding America says 883,000 Hoosiers struggle with hunger, and that includes 274,000 children. That's 1 in 8 adults, 1 in 6 children. There are 11 Feeding America food banks in Indiana. The Evansville-based Tri-State Food Bank is one of them. What does hunger look like in Kentucky? An estimated 662,000 Kentuckians are struggling with hunger, 190,000 of them children. That's 1 in 7 people in the Commonwealth, 1 in 5 children. There are 6 Feeding America food banks in Kentucky. One of them is the Evansville-based Tri-State Food Bank. And what does hunger look like in Illinois? 1.2 million Illinois residents are struggling with hunger. 363,000 of them, children. That's 1 in 10 residents, 1 in every 8 children. There are 7 Feeding America food banks in Illinois. And yes, one of them is, again, the Evansville-based Tri-State Food Bank. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Glenn Roberts. He's executive director of the Tri-State Food Bank, serving 33 counties in 3 states. And that statement alone brings up images of a maze of rules and regulations unique to every state. Can you talk about that just a moment?
Yes, we do get these government commodities. These are federal programs that we do, but they are administered through each individual state. And they're all a little bit different. Each state, you know, puts their own twist and a little turn on it and have maybe slightly different rules. So it's a lot of paperwork we've got to keep track of and be able to give them the numbers that they want. So it's a challenge, but it's worth it.
Talking about numbers, how much food are you shipping out, Glenn Roberts?
Let me give you some perspective, especially with the pandemic. Before COVID-19, I pulled these numbers recently. In the year 2019, the calendar year 2019, so no COVID, we were distributing 9.8 million pounds of food a year. I mean, a very respectable number. And then the calendar year 2020, almost all COVID, we distributed over 14 million pounds, 14.2 million pounds. So we have been working very hard, and it's a huge jump. And we may be on pace to distribute more like, 15 to 16 million pounds. So we've kind of leapfrogged, several years down the road in our strategic plan. It's hard to kind of, here's my bad pun, digest that kind of number and hard to relate to it. So here's how I do it. First of all, I like to think in terms of meals. We talk in pounds. We weigh everything that comes in and everything that goes out of the food bank. But if you're food insecure, you're not asking yourself, where's my next pound going to come from? You're asking, where's my next meal going to come from? So believe it or not, there is a conversion factor. The USDA has come up with this that we all of us food bankers agree to use it. And, well, David, I'll put you on the spot because this is what I do when I give tours. Think about, it all boils down to, what does an average meal weigh? So think about a meal on your plate, but don't count the plate, don't count the parsley, don't count the fork. What do you think that would weigh in terms of ounces or pounds?
I would say 14 ounces.
14 ounces? Not a bad guess at all. I've had folks say 4 pounds, and I'm going, now, you want to stop and think about that for just a little bit? You eat three meals a day? You did 12 pounds? 14 ounces is, I think, a pretty good guess. It's a little more than that. It's 19.2
ounces.
Oh,
really? I'm surprised by that.
Yeah. And well, it's a United States meal.
that's true.
Yeah, so 19 points. So that's 1.2 pounds. So take that 14 million number and divide by 1.2, and you get a 11 million something meals. 11 million meals. Let's take that another step, and this is where it resonates with me. Per day. That comes to about 32,000 meals per day that Tri-State Food Bank is supplying. Take it one more step. And I like to ask people to do this, to indulge me. David, just take a breath. Now exhale. That took about 3 seconds. Someone was fed. Someone in the Tri-State was fed a meal because of the work we do here at Tri-State Food. So as corny as it sounds, with every breath you take, someone gets a meal by virtue of the work we do at Tri-State Food. But that's what keeps me going.
That's a good sales pitch, definitely. Yeah. So all this food coming in and going out, how do you monitor the food safety, food quality?
Well, very carefully. We have very stringent rules to follow, and we are actually audited every couple of years by a third party comes in and sees, how we're doing with food safety. We have to have rodent control, insect control, the cold storage. We have an electronic monitoring system that it's like it does a ping every 5 minutes and records the temperature. So we're able to see, and of course it alerts us if the temperature gets outside of the parameters. So we spend a great deal of time making sure that we're following food safety, keeping that cold chain unbroken, keeping the place clean, and that's very, very important for us.
Now, the food drives, let's go back to that. One in particular has received a lot of attention over the years, the School Spirit Challenge. That's when you go out to these high schools and the kids try to get more canned goods than the other schools.
Yeah, it's actually called the Sunrise School Spirit. And I started off, it was my first year at the food bank, and a television reporter had come to the food bank, done a story on Tri-State Food Bank, had never been to a food bank and was, I think, enamored with what we did, came back to me a week later, said, I have an idea. And about going to the schools on a Friday morning, during football season, doing a pep rally and doing a food drive in conjunction with that, gives the kids a chance to be seen on TV. And I was game for it. I said, this sounds like a fun idea. Never knew it would take off like it did. It started off small, and we never set it out to be a competition, but we did report the poundage. And we'd say, okay, school number one brought in, let's say, 300 pounds. We never challenged anyone, but the next school would tell themselves, I think we can beat that. And it is. I mean, we've had schools bring in 50,000 pounds of food.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it would take three of our trucks to bring it back to the food bank. That's been extraordinary.
That's great. Now, also, you provide these school backpack lunches.
Yes, it's a big program of ours. It's the Weekend Backpack Food for Kids program. We've been doing it for...
Oh, that's a whole weekend of food.
Yes.
Okay.
It's for a weekend. That's the idea. This is for kids who are on the free lunch program. And they get a bag of food on Fridays with two breakfasts, two lunch, two dinner entrees, the shelf-stable milk, 100% juice boxes, some good nutritious snacks, fruit. And it's something that is, again, someone had this brilliant idea, and it took off across the country. So we're very proud of our backpack program.
And let's go from the kids to the seniors, and you have senior meals.
Yes. Again, our federal program that we do, the Community Supplemental Food Program, where we box up food and deliver it to an elderly, low-income, usually a shut-in senior. We distribute about 3,100 of those boxes a month, and that's a program that continues to grow. You see, a Tri-State Food Bank, I can sum it up in a very short sentence. It's kind of like an elevator speech, except it's an elevator short sentence. We supply food where it's needed most. And often I want to underscore the word most, because yes, many people are hungry, but it's the most vulnerable populations we are most concerned about, is children and senior citizens and those living in rural communities, you know, with that limited access of food. So we are building our whole strategy around that core mission. And in fact, the mobile food distribution program, we just hired an individual. That's their sole focus, is the mobile food distribution program. We are in the process of hiring a senior hunger programs coordinator, someone who will just focus on senior hunger. And this will allow us to restructure our staff. And one position that's right now doing both child and senior, they will focus just on child hunger. So we are really walking the walk and talking the talk.
What kind of feedback do you get from the different agencies and the people out in the field about what you're doing? Any personal stories of people being helped?
You know, the personal stories are actually a little bit difficult for us to get, because, you know, we are one step removed from actually feeding people. The feedback we get from our agencies, I must say, they do really appreciate us, and we really appreciate them. I mean, they are the ones on the front lines, and they're the ones who, I know they're helping people, and they're probably helping them personally. They're establishing relationships. I can tell one story that hit home at Tri-State Food Bank. Again, we don't feed individuals at the food bank. However, we have made an exception every now and then. One holiday season, we actually arranged to feed people at the food bank. We actually converted the warehouse into, it looked like a pantry, like a grocery store. And we had clients come in, and volunteers took them, had a grocery cart, and they were able to go through the warehouse just the way they would through a grocery store. Now, there was a volunteer who told me this story, and she came to me, her eyes were all misty. She was the volunteer in charge of giving out bread and pastries, and cakes and pies, you know, that extra little sweet that the families could get. And she said that she had these cakes that had been donated from a grocery store. And one of the cakes was decorated, you know, all with unicorns. And she said, I don't know why, but I set that cake over to the side. And she didn't know why she did it until later. A grandmother was going through the line, and she had her probably 6 or 7 year old granddaughter with her. And the grandmother asked the volunteer and said, you don't happen to have a cake with unicorns on it, do you? And of course, you know, she said, yes, I, and the little girl, you know, was just jumping up and down, said, I've never had a unicorn cake before. I've always wanted a unicorn cake. So tears were flowing. So when we do events like that and we hear those things, it's not just about filling bellies, and it's not just about providing, you know, sustenance just so you can live. It's about providing joy and hope, you know. And if a unicorn Kate can do that and and turn this girl's world, you know, around, that's it's all worth it.
How about an off-the-wall question for you? You have an intercom system there, I'm sure. Do you ever play classical music over the intercom? Any Vivaldi, Glenn?
No, there's no season for that. I certainly wish I could. I don't think that would go really well. I mean, I'd play not Vivaldi. If it were me, I'd be playing Prokofiev or Berlioz or Respighi, those things that have great trombone parts.
Oh,
Tchaikovsky,
there you go.
Yeah.
Well, Glenn Roberts, thank you so much for sharing the important work of the Tri-State Food Bank. Of course, now this is more important work than ever.
Yes.
Thanks so much for being my guest.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management. Fresh produce is always a welcome donation to the Tri-State Food Bank. The Southwestern Indiana Master Gardeners Association has a 1.2-acre display garden right off the Lloyd Expressway on Evansville's east side. Along with the many flowers and shrubs, there's a vegetable garden. On a previous 2 Main Street show, Master Gardener Rita Wiedig told me about the bountiful harvest.
I've worked there for 8 years harvesting, and we planted, but we also pick 3 times a week, 2 to 3 times a week, and take it to the food bank. And then the food pantry goes in and to the food bank and takes the products from the that's there into their different pantries or the soup kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
But it all goes to the food bank.
So how much do you harvest?
About 6,000 pounds this last year.
The Tri-State Food Bank is a member of the Feeding America Network, which is the nation's largest domestic hunger relief organization. For 40 years, Feeding America has been doing just that, providing food to people in need through a nationwide network of food banks. Here's a spot posted on the Feeding America website.
1 in 8 people in America struggle with hunger. For that one person, it isn't always clear where their next meal is coming from. That's why one meal can make all the difference. It begins when a meal like this comes through the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks. Before a meal can get to someone's table, it comes from a food pantry or meal program. There are 60,000 of these pantries and programs across America. They're places where many volunteer to help their struggling neighbors by supplying them with the meals they need. Before going there, this meal came from a food bank, a member of the Feeding America nationwide network that collects and distributes food. And before the food bank, before the food pantries and meal programs, this meal began with something else, an act of kindness. $1, one donation, 1 hour of someone's time. These acts of kindness come from businesses, farmers, national and state programs, and people like you. Together, these acts spread through the Feeding America network to bring meals to more than 46 million people every year. From one act of kindness to a food bank, pantry, or meal program, one meal can make a difference to the ones who need it most.
How can you help feed our hungry neighbors? Information on how to volunteer or donate is on the website tristatefoodbank.org. The volunteer opportunities include packing those weekend backpacks for children, sorting food from food drives, and packing meal boxes for senior citizens. Volunteers are needed Monday through Friday. You may select a morning or afternoon shift. Individuals and groups are welcome, and children as young as 8 may volunteer if accompanied by a parent or guardian. There's also a Saturday volunteer blitz every other Saturday from 9 to noon. And if you want to donate, you may do so online with the option of giving monthly to fight hunger all year round. At Tri-State Food Bank, $1 donated provides 7 meals. And these final stats from Glenn Roberts, the executive director, 1 in 5 people in the Tri-State is food insecure. The food bank supplies food to 250 feeding programs in 33 counties in Indiana, Kentucky, and Illinois. And in 2020, the Evansville-based Tri-State Food Bank distributed 14.6 million pounds of food, an incredible 49% increase in just 1 year. Next week on 2 Main Street, my conversation with Joe and Lori Blair. Joe, the well-known broadcaster, is recovering from a serious bout with COVID-19. Now, both of you, of course, were diagnosed with COVID-19, but Joe, you were slammed with the virus. What were those very first symptoms, Joe?
Oh, gosh. It was a sore throat and just kind of a little bit of a fever, kind of like we had the flu.
Mm-hmm. Lori, did you notice this?
She was sick at the same time.
I was sick at the same time, but with mine, it was the polar opposite. I was tired one afternoon, took a nap, woke up, and I couldn't smell for a week, and that was it. That was all I had.
Wow.
And my taste changed a little bit. Like, Raisin Bran tasted like that kasha stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You ever had that kasha?
Yes.
It's cereal, but it's not really cereal. But it kind of tasted like that to me. But I could taste something. And then I didn't get better. All the rest of the family got better. And finally, Lori and my youngest daughter came to me, who works at Columbia Healthcare, said, "Dad, you got to go to the ER. Let's go. Let's just see what they say." And I wasn't having a hard time breathing. But as soon as I got checked and they popped me in a hospital bed because I had double pneumonia, I couldn't breathe. And I'm not psychosomatic at all. So it picked that time to get me. And I was down, if you know anything about blood oxygen count, I was at like 82 to 85, which is struggling to breathe. And that started my days at Deaconess.
Was it over a month?
It was right at a month.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you in intensive care at all?
Intensive care 3 times.
Really?
They took me to intensive care my second day and a couple of times after that. Because I would get better, and they put me in a regular room. I was in 10 different rooms.
Really?
In 30 days, I was in 10 different rooms. And then they would move me back to intensive care because I'd have what I called an episode where I'd go way down to like 80% and couldn't breathe. And
were you ever on a ventilator?
They were going to put me on a ventilator once, but I kind of said, I don't want to go on one. They said, well, we'll see. Mm-hmm. You're close. So after about 5 or 10 minutes, my levels came up, and they said, I think we're going to be okay. You're going to be all right. We'll see.
The Blair family journey with COVID-19 and their careers in broadcasting and advertising, including 2 TV shows, Tasting the Tri-State and Golfing the Tri-State. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.